Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's really wonderful to be up here and have an opportunity to practice together and share the Dharma together. Thank you very much, and thank you for ordering up much better weather than what we had the last time I was supposed to come, and for being here on this really beautiful day. So, the title of this talk is something like The Way of Responsibility. And like many of the talks are really an opportunity to reflect more deeply on practice for me and something that's alive. And I had the experience not all that long ago of being aware of feeling responsible in a different kind of way than I had before. And I recognized it to be the fruit of practice, or an outgrowth of practice. And I thought I would bring that exploration here with you for your thoughts and experiences yourself. I tend to talk sometimes out of my own direct experience, and I'm going to talk with you in that way. But I really encourage you to listen to this with your whole body, and of your experience, what it's been like for you in practice. And this is just one path along the way. Stories are stories. Sometimes they're actually journeys. Sometimes they're actually the light of our way-seeking mind. And so think about your way-seeking mind in this way. I have to go back a little bit to set the stage for this story of an understanding that I came to or had a little differently on the night of our election in America. And I realized as I was putting this together, I thought, oh, I'm giving this talk in Canada. I wonder if they'll relate. It's not a partisan talk, just as a disclaimer, but it's out of my own experience of something that I recognized in myself. So I'm a physician, and for many years in the early part of my life, I worked in a county emergency room in Oakland, California, and that was in the late 80s and early 90s when there was a big crack epidemic and a lot of trauma. There still is a lot of trauma in Oakland. And I was working in the walk-in part of the emergency department. And in those days, people would queue up and stand in line before they saw a nurse. And they would stand in line sometimes for 5 and 6 and 8 hours before someone even took their vital signs and saw them. And we would be back in the back calling them over an overhead speaker, and they would walk back to 3 little cubicles divided by paper curtains. It's very horrific. All of us who worked there wanted to do a good job. We cared about being good people and kind people as we did that. And over time, I began to see that the workings of my own mind made that really difficult, that I had judgments, that I had irritabilities, that I missed people. That was my opening door to go to practice. And over time, I became the head of the clinic that actually became quite an amazing safety net, primary care safety net for people. As you may know, we don't have health care for everyone. So people go without, often going without, until they were in really dire straits. And so we became the place where people would come, sometimes regularly, to get their care. And we began to know people who most people would discount, people who were poor, mentally ill, homeless, on the street, some people who'd just been down on their luck, people who hadn't had the resources to get care and came in late into their disease. And we all saw it as a mission to provide good care and came to know and relate to these people as part of our community. We were all part of their community, shall we say, and those of us who worked there took it as that. Time went on, and resources for that kind of care dried up, and I moved along and went to work in primary care clinics instead. Fast forward, and I'm no longer living in Oakland, but I'm living here in the Pacific Northwest and in Bellingham. And on the night of the election, when it became clear that the government would be going to a much more corporate, individualistic kind of orientation, and that resources for my community would dry up even more, I had a momentary pang, you can hear in my thought, not momentary, I had this strong feeling of anguish. And then I had a feeling of clear resolve that I had never known before, actually, that kind of resolve. I've done human rights accompaniment in Central America. I obviously have been engaged in the world. But it was a very different kind of feeling than I had had before. And it just has had its own momentum. And I thought it was really interesting. You know, it was really interesting. It's something that felt to come outside of my own cognitive will, if you will. So I wanted to talk about my exploration of that and see how what your experience is. So I think we often grow up with the idea that we should be nice or kind. Yeah, most of us who are here probably have that as kind of a basics of our, whether it was our religion or our parents told us be nice now, or in our school, or our own inner voice, I should be good, whatever that means. That's not bad, you know, that's useful. But it's not really examined, and it's not always helpful, is it? Sometimes we totally miss what's going on with the other person because we have some idea. It's a tainted idea, right? Tainted in Buddhist terms, if you will, means that it's distorted by our own self-centered thinking. But it takes a long time to actually see the root of that. But we can recognize, oh, that wasn't so helpful. Or, huh, why did they look at me like that? I was just trying to help. Can be knowing too easily what's best or right, or presumptive or codependent, if you will, or paternalistic. In Buddhist terms, we call that also the tendency for the near enemy of true kindness, which is pity. We act out of a sense of pity or of hierarchy of someone who's disadvantaged or less than. So I was sitting here this morning, I was recalling the voice of a dear, dear friend who was the head nurse of that clinic when I started. And she said to me, you know, the white people who come to work here, they're do-gooders. We have many Dharma teachers, don't we? So as we mature, we begin to develop empathy. Empathy isn't so much about the ideas of being good. It's really more about the feel, the feelings of being good. It's not, I don't think, initially a kind of cortical activity. It's not really kind of here in my ideas, or a linguistic. You know, it's not something that we really express in language. It's something that we feel here. It's resonating with the plight of another, being moved by their suffering or their circumstances on a deeper kind of level, more visceral. There's a term in, neurobiology called limbic resonance that speaks to the idea that there's a capacity for sharing deep emotional states that arise from the limbic system of the brain. I think of that as a basic mammalian response we have between everyone. It's why I can be sitting here filling up with emotion, and some of you are too, right? It's why I think we feel the deep empathy of animals so much more readily, because it's not up here, it's here. They're not in the way that way. It's biological, and it's shared beyond the limits of this body. I'd say we're hardwired for empathy. So are elephants, and orcas, and dogs, and birds, and probably many other forms of life respond to our shared experience with each other. And so that opens us. Maybe it's one of the reasons why when we go out with nature, we can feel so much more relaxed and ease. We're under the canopy of care and resonance. Even drops of water are susceptible, aren't they? So empathy is an open door, but our minds can still get in the way. That's why I think in practice we cultivate compassion, right? That's of high value in Buddhist practice, is to be compassionate. Compassion, you all know, is the literal translation of to suffer with, to actually enter into the experience and be fully present for, to not turn away from, to be open and to receive in an unafraid way. That's the bodhisattva standard. But it needs to be cultivated. It's really hard. I remember the first time many years ago now, but I was been practicing for some time, and I was driving from somewhere, and there was a news report about the numbers of people who were starving in Rwanda. And I reached for the radio, and I went click. And I went, oh, it's that hard, isn't it? So we cultivate compassion in many different ways in practice. There are karuna, karuna, the Pali word for compassion. We generate compassion by repeating certain phrases. May all beings be happy. It's also part of the metta phrase. By setting our intentions to be kind, to do no harm. Sometimes when we practice with precepts, we do that too. We set our intention. Maybe we wake up first thing in the morning and we say, today I will be kind to everyone. Today I intend to really listen to people. And maybe we have a ritual also of at the end of the day reflecting on what that was like, what we experienced, how did we do, how do we do for ourselves too. We practice compassion by Sangha practice. Oh, Sangha is really one of the great gems. I had the great opportunity of being a part of a community that sat together 6 days a week. My teacher's idea was that it was a little monastery in the world. So we were bumping up against each other constantly during that time period. I get to see my mistakes, meaning, gosh, I thought I was being helpful there. Whoops. I get to see people's tolerance and kindness towards me. That's profound medicine, not the least of which is sometimes your teachers, but definitely each other. I get to see my Dharma brethren's mistakes, their shortcomings, but I know them to be really good people. I know them to be trying. As one of my Dharma sisters said, we just mess up. We don't mean to. We just mess up. And I see that they're not so different from me. So Sangha practice and actively cultivating compassion. I think our own self-examination is the foundation. To study our own habits and our tendencies that are deeply ingrained, we learn to understand them as products of causes and conditions and habit patterns, not actually who we are. Maybe who we manifest in this particular moment, but that's not actually who we are. Who we are isn't limited by just this, but is co-created by all of this now. So we cultivate compassion in these ways. Compassion, as you know, is one side of practice. Wisdom is the other main side of practice. Wisdom, morality, one of the three kind of baskets of practice. In our lineage, in our tradition, it's grounded in our particular 16 bodhisattva precepts. And many of you I see around the room have taken precepts. Probably all of you are familiar in some way with what they mean, if not in this tradition, in another tradition. The same kind of rules of how do we behave with each other in the world. And when we first learn them, they seem really daunting, right? I will not kill. Well, try that one, huh? I was working in my garden the other day, and I was turning up the sod that had grown around the blueberry plants, and despite my best efforts, I killed a number of earthworms. It was really very difficult to see how easy it is to be that callous and to take life. There's no way around it. So how do we possibly practice precepts? Over time, though, we learn that precepts are not a matter of good and bad and right and wrong. They're guidelines, right? Just like being kind is kind of a guideline. It's kind of like, well, I want to aim in that direction, not too far off there. I don't want to go back there, but it's not the complete thing. They're situational, right? This is the bodhisattva's response. What's an appropriate response in the individual situation? When a truck driver is in a snowstorm and is going to freeze to death, the truck driver, and even though his contract says he can't leave his truck, he has to leave his truck, right? Situational precepts say, in this response right here to protect life, the best response in this circumstance is to chuck the machine and take care of the person. Not that machines shouldn't be taken care of, but you get my point, right? Anyway, so we learn this about precepts, and we learn, boy, this is a lot harder than I thought. I can't just follow this rule. I have to actually be aware in all of these circumstances to know what to do. And then there's another level, I think, of morality or contact concept that is transcendent to that. It's beyond a good or bad. It's beyond a right or wrong. It's beyond someone doing and someone not doing. There's no giver, no receiver, and no gift. That's true wisdom, where there's just activity that's appropriate in the moment. And the first time I saw that was when I was in Bodh Gaya for a teaching. The Dalai Lama was there, and there were tens of thousands of lamas who were there. And we would walk every morning down the same pathway, run the gauntlet of all the beggars that were sitting there, walk down the pathway to get to the big tents where we would hear the teachings, and everyone would be lined up as is partially cultural. That's how people support themselves and are supported there. And run the gauntlet is intentional to tell you what it felt like internally to be walking by people whose lives were, for no fault of their own, so much more difficult than mine. And I saw one of the lamas stop and hand a coin to the beggar. And the beggar received it as if the lama had just been given the greatest gift. And the Lama gave it as if he had just gotten the greatest gift. It was truly beautiful. I think that's how we express our bodhisattva precepts. There's no thought of what the person is, who the person is, or who I am in that. So, I'm seeing that I save paper by putting this in the wrong way. So let me collect my thoughts here for a second. There's something underneath the cultivation of compassion and wisdom that guides us. It's the same thing that brought you all to practice, I think, which is a deep faith. A deep faith in your life, in some way in life. Maybe it's not so apparent that it's yours for a long time, but in life, that deep abiding faith that these qualities of compassion and wisdom are inherent within all of us. Like the green grass grows through the cracks in the sidewalk. If you get out of the way, that's the natural tendency to move forward. In the same way that there is this basic animalistic mammalian, if you will, life, we don't know yet exactly what plants feel, that calls us together, that forms relationship together. And over time, with cultivation of the qualities of kindness, particularly kindness in our culture, particularly kindness for ourselves in this culture, the study of our own minds to slowly, deeply, over 10, 20, 30 years, to see our self-centered thinking, see how we create the world in our own image and our own ideas over and over again with humility. See how that's true for everyone else over and over again with humility, and how we're made, we share that same ground. Recently, I wasn't there. The senior students at my old temple got together. They've been processing some difficult events that have happened there. And in that room of about 16 senior students, there were over 400 years of practice. And the great insight that people had was that it was almost impossible to really be able to communicate with each other. Isn't that amazing? How deep and difficult it is to actually really hear. Wow. Boy, does that open you wide up in curiosity and wonder and put you in your place. And I don't mean put you in a low place. I just mean, oh, so I have my place, right? I have a place that I reside from, and it's really different from everyone else's, even though I might have been their closest friend for 40 years. It's so really different. You know, Uchiyama Roshi said, you know this quote, you can't as much share a fart with another person. Yeah, it's like that. And of course, Zazen cultivates this soil that brings together wisdom and compassion, and we recognize this deep faith in our own lives. That faith, our own birthright, our own inherent Buddha nature, that is what unfetters the bodhisattva activity. So truly, you know, we don't sit to look pretty on a cushion, we don't just have compassion, Avalokiteshvara, or wisdom, Manjushri, but we have activity. Our life is outside the gate. Our life is movement. It is an activity with all other activities. Oh, I jumped. Hold on. Maybe that's good enough. Well, let me just go back for a second and say this wisdom, this lack of self-centeredness, this non-discrimination, we no longer judge people in the same way, like not liking certain people or kinds of people. We don't put ourselves above or below. The head of our emergency department in those days used to say all of our patients were citizens. And I thought that was so beautiful. Everyone mattered equally. They weren't drunks, mentally ill, non-compliant, but someone just like me in different circumstances. We become confident in our place in the world, totally supported by everything. We know that we're a part of a structure of total dynamic working, as integral as the mycorrhizal fungi that allow a forest to flourish that might otherwise die, as the wolf to the rivers, directions, and Yosemite, as George Bailey to the welfare of everyone in Bedford Falls, New York, and It's a Wonderful Life. We take our rightful place in the world. We inhabit all of our lives and our function. I occupy a place, a role, and a position, and so does each and every person. We meet, and what is needed is seen and enacted in this moment. The precepts become a natural expression of our life. This is the way of responsibility. I think it's how we come to feel responsible as Buddhist practitioners. You know, usually when I embarked on this, I thought, you know, people don't talk about responsibility in Zen so much. I dutifully Googled responsibility to see all the talks that would pop up. There weren't any. Doesn't mean they haven't been given. Usually, responsibility means having a duty or a burden to deal with, or some kind of state of being accountable or to blame for something. You know, the whole catastrophe of our lives, we're to blame for everything, aren't we? Or a moral obligation to behave correctly towards or in respect of. I say, dig deeper. Dig deeper. That responsibility exists just because of who we are, where we are in this moment. My teacher has said, the whole world takes care of us and we are responsible for the whole world. We are responsible for the whole world. Or you might say, we depend on the whole world for our lives and the whole world depends on us. Usually we think about this as a ledger to be balanced or payback. But as practitioners, we understand the way of responsibility is a natural expression, not just of our gratitude or precepts, but of our life. There's no ledger, nothing better, nothing's worse, nothing is in debt to another, nothing's above or below. Each has its own virtue. Everything is equal in its virtue. All equal, carrying the load or holding hands and skipping down the street together, whichever way you want to do it. Many of you probably know the story of Dogen visiting the Tenzo. There are two of them, yes? The Tenzo, he's at Tien Tong Monastery where he met his teacher. And that position was held by a cook who was 68 years old. Old man by those standards. It's midday sun and he's out gathering mushrooms to dry. Okay? He's an old man, he's practiced a long time. He should be at the prime of his teaching and his enlightenment. What's he doing harvesting mushrooms when it's zapping all of his energy. So Dogen goes up to him and says, hey, what gives? Why are you spending your time doing that? Why not ask other people to help out so you can attend to more important things? And the Tenzo looks at him and says, if not me, who? And Dogen says, well, Well, but why under the sun? Why don't you do it another time? And the Tenzo says, if not now, when? That's our practice. It's not only my role, but it's my Dharma position. The Dharma position is who I am manifesting in this moment, in this time, in this place, right now. To fully take our Dharma position in the world is to be responsible. Like the green grass grows, like the fruit bud opens, or like the hand reaches for the pillow in the middle of the night. So thank you, that's what I have to say. I don't know if normally you take questions or if there's time or what you do.
Do you have the time? We should probably wrap up, I think.
Okay.
And maybe people can talk in the back a little bit afterwards.
Okay, well thank you very much for your attention and I look forward to tea.